Hello, hello, welcome back to another section of Gentlemen in Moscow by Amor Towles. Apologies, it's been a while. I've been away, and you might see my leg is kind of sticking out. I was in a hiking accident, so I've got my leg elevated and icing here, but figured it'd be a good time to read. We can get a lot of sections done here while I'm staying off my feet. But also, if you're new around here, my name's Julie and I read books on this channel. So, you know, stick around for this book. I'm very excited to get more into it. And if you're liking them, hit the like and let's jump right in. Where did we leave off last time? Oh, yes, we left off on page 26, if you're following along in a copy like this, with the little star. All right. And again, apologies for the traffic noise. This is just the best place in my apartment for it, so we'll hope that they stay relatively quiet. All right, without any further ado, after the star on page 26. Tucked discreetly into the northeast corner of the hotel's second floor was the Boyarsky, the finest restaurant in Moscow, if not in all of Russia. With vaulted ceilings and dark red walls reminiscent of a boyar's retreat, the Boyarsky boasted the city's most elegant decor, its most sophisticated waitstaff, and its most subtle chef de cuisine. So renowned was the experience of dining at the Boyarsky that on any given night, one might have to elbow one's way through a crowd of hopefuls just to catch the eye of Andrei as he presided over the large black book in which the names of the fortunate were set down. And when beckoned ahead by the maître d', one could expect to be stopped five times in four languages on the way to one's table in the corner, where one would be served flawlessly by a waiter in a white dinner jacket. That is, one could expect this until 1920, when, having already sealed the borders, the Bolsheviks decided to prohibit the use of rubles in fine restaurants, effectively closing them to 99% of the population. So tonight, as the Count began to eat his entree, water glasses clinked against cutlery, couples whispered awkwardly, and even the best of waiters found himself staring at the ceiling. But every period has its virtues, even a time of turmoil. While Emil Zhukovsky was lured to the Metropole as chef de cuisine in 1912, he was given command of a seasoned staff and a sizable kitchen. In addition, he had the most celebrated larder east of Vienna. On his spice shelves was a compendium of the world's predilections, and in his cooler, a comprehensive survey of birds and beasts hanging from hooks by their feet. At such, one might naturally leap to the conclusion that 1912 had been a perfect year in which to measure the chef's talents, but in a period of abundance, any half-wit with a spoon can please a palate. To truly test a chef's ingenuity, one must instead look to a period of want. And what provides want better than war? In the revolution's aftermath, with its economic declines, failed crops, and halted trade, refined ingredients became as scarce in Moscow as butterflies at sea. The Metropole's larder was depleted bushel by bushel, pound by pound, dash by dash, and its chef was left to meet the expectations of his audience with cornmeal, cauliflower, and cabbage. That is to say, with whatever he could get his hands on. Yes, some claimed Emil Zhukovsky was a curmudgeon, and others called him abrupt. Some said he was a short man with a short temper, but none could dispute his genius. Just consider the dish the Count was finishing at that very moment. A saltimbocca fashioned from necessity. In place of a cutlet of veal, Emil had pounded flat a breast of chicken. In place of prosciutto di Parma, he had shaved a Ukrainian ham. And in place of sage, that delicate leaf that binds the flavors together, he had opted for an herb that was as soft and aromatic as sage, but more bitter to the taste. It wasn't basil or oregano, or that the Count was certain, but he had definitely encountered it somewhere before. "How is everything this evening, Your Excellency?" "Ah, Andrei, as usual, everything is perfect." "And the saltimbocca?" "Inspired." But I do have one question. The herb that Emile has tucked under the ham, I know it isn't sage. By any chance, is it nettle? Nettle? I don't believe so, but I will inquire. Then with a bow, the maitre d' excused himself. Without a doubt, Emile Zakovsky was a genius, reflected the Count, but the man who secured the Boyarsky's reputation for excellence by ensuring that all within its walls ran smoothly was André Duras. Born in the south of France, André was handsome, tall, and graying at the temples, but his most distinguishing feature was not his looks, his height, or his hair. It was his hands. Pale and well manicured, his fingers were half an inch longer than the fingers of most men his height. He had been a pianist. André could easily have straddled a 12th. Had he been a puppeteer, he could have performed the sword fight between Macbeth and Macduff, as all three witches looked on. But André was neither a pianist nor a puppeteer, or at least not in the traditional sense. He was the captain of the Boyarsky, and one watched in wonder as his hands fulfilled their purpose at every turn. Having just led a group of women to their table, for instance, André seemed to pull back their chairs all at once. When one of the ladies produced a cigarette, he had a lighter in one hand and was guarding the flame with the other, as if a draft had ever been felt within the walls of the Boyarsky. And when the woman holding the wine list asked for a recommendation, he didn't point to the 1900 Bordeaux, at least not in the Teutonic sense. Rather, he slightly extended his index finger in a manner reminiscent of that gesture on the Sistine Chapel's ceiling with which the prime mover transmitted the spark of life. Then, excusing himself with a bow, he crossed the room and went through the kitchen door. But before a minute could pass, the door swung open, and there was Emile. 5'5" and 200 pounds, the chef glanced quickly about the room, then marched toward the Count with André trailing behind. As he crossed the dining room, the chef knocked into a customer's chair and nearly toppled a busboy with his tray. Coming to an abrupt stop at the Count's table, he looked him up and down as one might measure an opponent before challenging him to a duel. "Bravo, monsieur," he said in a tone of indignation. "Bravo." Then he turned on his heels and disappeared back into his kitchen. André, a little breathless, bowed to express both apologies and congratulations. "Nettle it was, Your Excellency. Your palate remains unsurpassed." Though the Count was not a man to gloat, he could not repress a smile of satisfaction. Knowing that the Count had a sweet tooth, André gestured toward the dessert cart. "May I bring you a slice of plum tart with our compliments?" "Thank you for the thought, André. Normally I would leap at the chance, but tonight I am otherwise committed." Having acknowledged that a man must master his circumstances or otherwise be mastered by them, the Count thought it worth considering how one was most likely to achieve this aim when one had been sentenced to a life of confinement. For Edmond Dantès, in the Chateau d'If, it was thoughts of revenge that kept him clear-minded. Unjustly imprisoned, he sustained himself by plotting the systematic undoing of his personal agents of villainy. For Cervantes, enslaved by pirates in Algiers, it was the promise of pages as yet unwritten that spurred him on, while for Napoleon on Elba, strolling among chickens, fending off flies, and sidestepping puddles of mud, it was visions of a triumphal return to Paris that galvanized his will to persevere. But the Count hadn't the temperament for revenge. He hadn't the imagination for epics, and he certainly hadn't the fanciful ego to dream of empires restored. No. His model for mastering his circumstances would be a different sort of captive altogether, an Anglican washed ashore. Like Robinson Crusoe stranded on the Isle of Despair, the Count would maintain his resolve by committing to the business of practicalities. Having dispensed with dreams of quick discovery, the world's Crusoes seek shelter and a source of fresh water. They teach themselves to make fire from flint. They study their island's topography, its climate, its flora and fauna, all the while keeping their eyes trained for sails on the horizon and footprints in the sand. The It was to this end that the Count had given the old Greek 3 notes to deliver. Within a matter of hours, the Count had been visited by 2 messengers, a young lad from Muir and Mirelles, bearing the fine linens and a suitable pillow, and another from Petrovsky Passage, with 4 bars of the Count's favorite soap. And the third respondent? She must have arrived while the Count was at dinner, for waiting on his bed was a light blue box with a single millefeuille. Page 31. An appointment. Never had the chime of 12 been so welcome. Not in Russia, not in Europe, not in all the world. Had Romeo been told by Juliet that she would appear at her window at noon, the young Veronin's rapture at the appointed hour could not have matched the Count's. Had Dr. Stahlbaum's children, Fritz and Clara, been told on Christmas morning that the drawing-room doors would be opened at midday, their elation could not have rivaled the Count's upon the sounding of the first toll. For having successfully fended off thoughts of Tverskaya Street and chance encounters with young ladies of fashion, having bathed, dressed, and finished his coffee and fruit, today a fig, shortly after 10, the Count had eagerly taken up Montaigne's masterpiece, only to discover that at every 15th line, his gaze was drifting toward the clock. Admittedly, the Count had felt a touch of concern when he'd first lifted the book from the desk the day before. For, as a single volume, it had the density of a dictionary or Bible, those books that one expects to consult, or possibly peruse, but never read. But it was the Count's review of the contents, a list of 107 essays on the likes of constancy, moderation, solitude, and sleep, that confirmed his initial suspicion that the book had been written with winter nights in mind. Without a doubt, it was a book for when the birds had flown south, the wood was stacked by the fireplace, and the fields were white with snow. That is, for when one had no desire to venture out, and one's friends had no desire to venture in. Nonetheless, with a resolute glance at the time, much as a seasoned sea captain, when setting out on an extended journey, will log the exact hour he set sail from port, the Count plowed once again into the waves of the first meditation. By diverse means, we arrive at the same end. In this opening essay, in which examples were expertly drawn from the annals of history, the author provided a most convincing argument that when one is at another's mercy, one should plead for one's life. Or remain proud and unbent. At any rate, having firmly established that either approach might be the right one, the author proceeded to his second meditation of sadness. Here, Montaigne quoted an array of unimpeachable authorities from the Golden Age who confirmed conclusively that sadness is an emotion best shared or kept to oneself. It was somewhere in the middle of the third essay that the Count found himself glancing at the clock for the fourth or fifth time, or was it the sixth? While the exact number of glances could not be determined, the evidence did seem to suggest that the Count's attention had been drawn to the clock more than once. But then, what a chronometer it was! Made to order for the Count's father by the venerable firm of Bruggett, the twice-twirling clock was a masterpiece in its own right. Its white enamel face had the circumference of a grapefruit, and its lapis lazuli body sloped asymptotically from its top to its base. I'm guessing that's like asymmetrically. While its jeweled inner workings had been cut by craftsmen known the world over for an unwavering commitment to precision. And their reputation was certainly well-founded, for as he progressed through the third essay, in which Plato, Aristotle, and Circio had been crowded onto the couch with the Emperor Maximilian, the Count could hear every tick. 10:20 and 56 seconds, the clock said. 10:20 and 57, 58, 59. Why this clock accounted the seconds as flawlessly as Homer accounted his Dactyls and Peter the Sins of the Sinners? But where were they? But where were we? Ah yes, essay three. The Count shifted in his chair a little leftward in order to put the clock out of view. Then he searched for the passage he'd been reading. He was almost certain it was in the fifth paragraph on the 15th page, but as he delved back into that paragraph's prose, the context seemed utterly unfamiliar, as did the paragraphs that immediately preceded it. In fact, he had to turn back three whole pages before he found a passage that he recalled well enough to resume his progress in good faith. "Is that how it is with you?" the Count demanded of Montaigne. "One step forward and two steps back." Maybe it's Montaigne. Intent upon showing who was master of whom, the Count vowed that he would not look up from the book again until he had reached the 25th essay. Spurred by his own resolve, the Count made quick work of essays 4, 5, and 6, and when he dispatched 7 and 8 with even more alacrity, the 25th essay seemed as close at hand as a pitcher of water on a dining room table. But as the Count advanced through essays 11, 12, and 13, his goal seemed to recede into the distance. It was suddenly as if the book were not a dining room table at all, but a sort of Sahara. And having emptied his canteen, the Count would soon be crawling across its sentences with the peak of each hard-won page revealing but another page beyond. And then, so be it, onward crawled the Count. On past the hour of 11, on past the 16th essay. Until suddenly, that long-strided watchman of the minutes caught up with his bow-legged brother at the top of the dial. As the two embraced, the springs within the clock casing loosened, the wheel spun, and the miniature hammer fell, setting off the first of those dulcet tones that signaled the arrival of noon. The front feet of the Count's chair fell to the floor with a bang, and Monsieur Montaigne turned twice in the air before landing on the bed covers. By the fourth chime, the Count was rounding the belfry stairs, and by the eighth, he was passing lobby en route to the lower floor for his weekly appointment with Yaroslav Yaroslavl, the peerless barber of the Metropole Hotel. We're on page 32 with the star. Page break. For over two centuries, or so historians tell us, it was from the St. Petersburg salons that our country's culture advanced. For those great rooms overlooking the Fontanka Channel, new cuisines, fashions, and ideas took their first tentative steps into Russian society. But if this was so, it was largely due to the hive of activity beneath the parlor floors. For there, just a few steps below street level, were the butlers, cooks, and footmen, who together ensured that when the notions of Darwin or Manet were first bandied about, all went off without a hitch. And so it was in the Metropole. Ever since its opening in 1905, the hotel's suites and restaurants had been a gathering spot for the glamorous, influential, and erudite. But the effortless elegance on display would not have existed without the services of the lower floor. Coming off the wide marble steps that descended from the lobby, one first passed the newsstand, which offered a gentleman 100 headlines, albeit now just in Russian. Next was the shop of Fatima Fedorova, the florist. A natural casualty of the times, Fatima's shelves had been emptied and her windows papered over back in 1920, turning one of the hotel's brightest spots into one of its most forlorn. But in its day, the shop had sold flowers by the acre. Had provided the towering arrangements for the lobby, the lilies for the rooms, and the bouquets of roses that were tossed at the feet of the Bolshoi ballerinas, as well as the boutonnieres and the men who did the tossing. What's more, Fatima was fluent in the floral codes that had governed polite society since the age of chivalry. Not only did she know the flower that should be sent as an apology, she knew which flower to send when one has been late, when one has spoken out of turn, and one having taken notice of the young lady at the door, one has carelessly overtrumped one's partner. In short, Fatima knew a flower's fragrance, color, and purpose better than a bee. Well, Fatima's may have been shuttered, reflected the Count, but weren't the flower shops of Paris shuttered under the reign of Robespierre? And didn't that city now abound in blooms? Just so, the time for flowers in the Metropole would surely come again. At the very end of the hall, one finally came to Yaroslav's barbershop. A land of optimism, precision, and political neutrality, it was the Switzerland of the hotel. If the Count had vowed to master his circumstances through practicalities, then here was a glimpse of the means, a religiously kept appointment for a weekly trip. When the Count entered the shop, Yaroslav was attending to a silver-haired customer in a light gray suit, while a heavyset fellow in a rumpled jacket bided his time in the bench by the wall. Greeting the Count with a smile, the barber directed him to the empty chair at his side. As the Count climbed into the chair, he offered a friendly nod to the heavyset fellow, then leaned back and let his eyes settle on that marvel of Yaroslav's shop, his cabinet. Were one to ask Larousse to define the word cabinet, he acclaimed lexicographer might reply, a piece of furniture often adorned with decorative detail in which items may be stowed away from sight. A serviceable definition, no doubt, one that would encompass everything from a kitchen cupboard in the countryside to a Chippendale in Buckingham Palace. But Yaroslav's cabinet would not fit so neatly into such a description, for having been made solely of nickel and glass, it had been designed not to hide its contents, but to reveal them to the naked eye. And rightfully so, for his cabinet could be proud of all it contained. French soaps wrapped in waxed papers, British lathers in ivory drums, Italian tonics in whimsically shaped vials, and hidden in the back, that little black bottle that Yaroslav referred to with a wink as the Fountain of Youth. In the mirror's reflection, the Count now let his gaze shift to where Yaroslav was working his magic on the silver-haired gentleman with two sets of scissors. In Yaroslav's hands, the scissors initially recalled the entrechat of the danseur in a ballet, his legs switching back and forth in midair. But as the barber progressed, his hands moved with increasing speed until they leapt and kicked like a Cossack doing the hopuk. Upon the execution of the final snip, it would have been perfectly appropriate for a curtain to drop only to be raised again a moment later so the audience could applaud as the barber took a bow. Yaroslav swung the white cape off his customer and stepped it in the air. He clicked his heels when accepting payment for a job well done. And as the gentleman exited the shop looking younger and more distinguished than when he'd arrived, the barber approached the Count with a fresh cape. "Your Excellency, how are you?" "Splendid, Yaroslav, at my utmost. And what is on the docket for today?" "Just a trim, my friend, just a trim." As the scissors began their delicate snipping, it seemed to the Count that the heavyset customer on the bench had undergone something of a transformation. Although the Count had given his friendly nod just moments before, in the interim, the fellow's face seemed to have taken on a rosier hue. The Count was sure of it. In fact, because the color was spreading to his ears. The Count tried to make eye contact again, intending to offer another friendly nod, but the fellow had fixed his gaze on Yaroslav's back. "I was next," he said. Yaroslav, who like most artists, tended to lose himself in his craft, continued clipping away with efficiency and grace, so the fellow was forced to repeat himself, if a little more emphatically. "I was next." Drawn from his artistic spell by the sharper intonation, Yaroslav offered a courteous reply. "I will be with you in just a moment, sir." "That is what you said when I arrived." This was said with such unmistakable hostility that Yaroslav paused in his clipping and turned to meet his customer's glare with a startled expression. Though the Count had been raised never to interrupt a conversation, he felt that the barber should not be put in the position of having to explain the situation on his behalf, so he interceded. "Yaroslav meant no offense, my good man. It just so happens that I have a standing appointment at 12 o'clock on Tuesdays." The fellow now turned his glare upon the Count. "A standing appointment," he repeated. "Yes." Then he rose so abruptly that he knocked his bench back into the wall at full height. He was no more than 5'6". His fists, which jutted from the cuffs of his jacket, were as red as his ears. When he advanced a step, Yaroslav backed against the edge of his counter. The fellow took another step toward the barber and wrested one of the scissors from his hand. Then, with the deftness of a much slighter man, he turned, took the count by the collar, and severed the right wing of his mustache with a single snip. Tightening his hold, he pulled the count forward until they were nearly nose to nose. "You'll have your appointment soon enough," he said. Then, shoving the count back in the chair, he tossed the scissors on the floor and strolled from the shop. "Your Excellency!" exclaimed Yaroslav aghast. "I have never seen the man in my life. I don't even know if he resides in the hotel, but he is not welcome here again, I assure you of that." The count, who was standing now, was inclined to echo Yaroslav's indignation and commend a punishment that fit the crime. But then, what did the count know about his assailant? When he had first seen him sitting on the bench in his rumpled jacket, the count had summed him up in an instant as some hard-working sort who, having stumbled upon the barbershop, had decided to treat himself to a cut. For all the count knew, this fellow could have been one of the new residents on the second floor. Having come of age in an ironworks, he could have joined a union in 1912, led a strike in 1916, captained a Red Battalion in 1918, and now found himself in command of an entire industry. "He was perfectly right," the count said to Yaroslav. He had been waiting in good faith. You only wished to honor my appointment. It was for me to see the chair and suggest that you attend to him first. But what are we to do?" The count turned to the mirror and surveyed himself. He surveyed himself, perhaps, for the first time in years. Long had he believed that a gentleman should turn to a mirror with a sense of distrust, for rather than being tools of self-discovery, mirrors tended to be tools of self-deceit. How many times had he watched a young beauty turn 30 degrees before her mirror to ensure that she saw herself to the best advantage, as if henceforth all the world would see her solely from that angle? How often had he seen a grande dame don a hat that was horribly out of fashion, but that seemed au courant to her because her mirror had been framed in the style of the same bygone era? The count took pride in wearing a well-tailored jacket, but he took greater pride in knowing that a gentleman's presence was best announced by his bearing, his remarks, and his manners, not by the cut of his coat. Yes, thought the count, the world does spin. In fact, it spins on its axis even as it revolves around the sun. And the galaxy turns as well, a wheel within a greater wheel, producing a chime of an entirely different nature than that of a tiny hammer in a clock. And when that celestial chime sounds, perhaps a mirror will suddenly serve its truer purpose, revealing to a man not who he imagines himself to be, but who he has become. The count resumed his place in the chair. "A clean shave," he said to the barber. "A clean shave, my friend."
Except while we have some traffic noise.
This is Honeycrisp, my little friend here, on page 38. An acquaintanceship. There were two restaurants in the Hotel Metropole, the Boyarsky, that fabled retreat on the second floor that we have already visited, and the grand dining room of the lobby known officially as the Metropole, but referred to affectionately by the Count as the Piazza. Admittedly, the Piazza could not challenge the excellence of the Boyarsky's decor, the sophistication of its service, or the subtlety of its cuisine. But the Piazza did not aspire to elegant service or subtlety. With 80 tables scattered around a marble fountain and a menu offering everything from cabbage, pierogi, to cutlets of veal, the Piazza was meant to be an extension of the city, of its gardens, markets, and thoroughfares. It was a place where Russians cut from every cloth could come to linger over coffee, happen upon friends, stumble into arguments, or drift into dalliances, and where the lone diner seated under the great glass ceiling could indulge himself in admiration, indignation, suspicion, and laughter without getting up from his chair. And the waiters, like those of a Parisian cafe, the Piazza's waiters could be best be complimented as efficient. Accustomed to navigating crowds, they could easily seat a party of eight at a table of four. Having noted your preferences over the sound of the orchestra, within minutes they would return to the various drinks balanced on a tray and dispense them around the table in rapid succession without misplacing a glass. If, with your menu in hand, you hesitated for even a second to place your order, they would lean over your shoulder and poke at a specialty of the house, and when the last morsel of dessert had been savored, they would whisk away your plate, present your check, and make your change in under a minute. In other words, the waiters of the piazza knew their trade to the crumb, the spoon, and the kopeck. At least, that was how things were before the war. Today, the dining room was nearly empty, and the count was being served by someone who appeared not only new to the piazza, but new to the art of waiting. Tall and thin, with a narrow head and superior demeanor, he looked rather like a bishop that had been plucked from a chessboard. When the count took his seat, with a newspaper in hand, the international symbol of dining alone, the chap didn't bother to clear the second setting. When the count closed his menu and placed it beside his plate, the international symbol of readiness to order, the chap needed to be beckoned with a wave of the hand. And when the count ordered the okroshka and fillet of sole, the chap asked if he might like a glass of sauterne. A perfect suggestion, no doubt, if only the count had ordered foie gras. Perhaps a bottle of the Chateau de Baudelaire, the count corrected politely. Of course, the bishop replied with an ecclesiastical smile. Granted, a bottle of the Baudelaire was something of an extravagance for a solitary lunch, but after spending another morning with the indefatigable Michel de Montaigne, the count felt that his morale could use the boost. For several days, in fact, he had been fending off a state of restlessness. On his regular descent to the lobby, he caught himself counting the steps. As he browsed the headlines in his favorite chair, he found he was lifting his hands to twirl the tips of his mustaches that were no longer there. He found he was walking through the door of the piazza at 12:01 for lunch, and at 1:35, when he climbed the 110 steps to his room, he was already calculating the minutes until he could come back downstairs for a drink. If he continued along this course, it would not take long for the ceiling to edge downward, the walls to edge inward, and the floor to edge upward, until the entire hotel had been collapsed into the size of a biscuit tin. As the count waited for his wine, he gazed around the restaurant, but his fellow diners offered no relief. Across the way was a table occupied by two stragglers from the diplomatic corps, who picked up their food while they awaited an era of diplomacy. Over there in the corner was a spectacled denizen of the second floor with four enormous documents spread across his table, comparing them word for word. No one appeared particularly gay, and no one paid the count any mind. That is, except for the young girl with the penchant for yellow, who appeared to be spying on him from her table behind the fountain. According to Vasily, this 9-year-old with straight blonde hair was the daughter of a widowed Ukrainian bureaucrat. As usual, she was sitting with her governess. When she realized the count was looking her way, she disappeared behind her menu. "Your soup," said the bishop. "Ah, thank you, my good man. It looks delicious, but don't forget the wine." "Of course." Turning his attention to his okroshka, the count could tell at a glance that it was a commendable execution, a bowl of soup that any Russian in the room might have been served by his grandmother. Closing his eyes in order to give the first spoonful its due consideration, the count noted a suitably chilled temperature, a tad too much salt, a tad too much kvass, but a perfect expression of dill, that harbinger of summer which brings to mind the songs of crickets and the setting of one's soul at ease. When the count opened his eyes, he nearly dropped his spoon, for standing at the edge of his table was the young girl with the penchant for yellow, studying him with that unapologetic interest peculiar to children and dogs. Adding to the shock of her sudden appearance was the fact that her dress today was in the shade of a lemon. "Where did they go?" she asked, without a word of introduction.
"I beg your pardon, where did who go?"
She tilted her head to take a closer look at his face. Why, your mustaches. The Count had not much cause to interact with children, but he had been raised well enough to know that a child should not idly approach a stranger, should not interrupt him in the middle of a meal, and certainly should not ask him questions about his personal appearance. Was the minding of one's own business no longer a subject taught in schools? Like swallows, the Count answered, they traveled elsewhere for the summer. Then he fluttered a hand from the table in the air in order to both mimic the flight of the swallows and suggest how a child might follow suit. She nodded to express her satisfaction with his response. I too will be traveling elsewhere for part of the summer. The Count inclined his head to indicate his congratulations. To the Black Sea, she added. Then she pulled back the empty chair and sat. Would you like to join me? He asked. By way of response, she wiggled back and forth to make herself comfortable, then rested her elbows on the table. Around her neck hung a small pendant on a golden chain, some lucky charm or locket. The Count looked toward the young lady's governess with the hopes of catching her attention, but she had obviously learned from experience to keep her nose in her book. The girl gave another canine tilt to her head. Is it true that you are a count? 'Tis true. Her eyes widened. Have you ever known a princess? I have known many princesses. Her eyes widened further, then narrowed. Was it terribly hard to be a princess? Terribly. At that moment, despite the fact that half the okroshka remained in his bowl, the bishop appeared with the count's fillet of sole and swapped one for the other. Thank you, said the count, his spoon still in hand. Of course. The count opened his mouth to inquire as to the whereabouts of the Baudelaire, but the bishop had already vanished. When the count turned back to his guest, she was staring at his fish. What is that? She wanted to know. This, it is fillet of sole. Is it good? Didn't you have a lunch of your own?
I didn't like it.
The count transferred a taste of his fish to a side plate and passed it across the table. With my compliments. She forked the whole thing in her mouth. It's yummy, she said, which, if not the most elegant expression, was at least factually correct. Then she smiled a little sadly and let out a sigh as she directed her bright blue gaze upon the rest of his lunch. Said the Count. Retrieving the side plate, he transferred half his sole along with an equal share of spinach and baby carrots and returned it. She wiggled back and forth once more, presumably to settle in for the duration. Then, having carefully pushed the vegetables to the side edge of the plate, she cut her fish into four equal portions, put the right upper quadrant in her mouth, and resumed her line of inquiry. How would a princess spend her day? Like any young lady, answered the Count. With a nod of the head, the girl encouraged him to continue. In the morning, she would have lessons in French, history, music. After her lessons, she might visit with friends or walk in the park, and at lunch, she would eat her vegetables. My father says that princesses personify the decadence of a vanquished era. The Count was taken aback. Perhaps a few, he conceded, but not all, I assure you. She waved her fork. Don't worry, Papa is wonderful, and he knows everything there is to know about the workings of tractors, but he knows absolutely nothing about the workings of princesses. The Count offered an expression of relief. Have you ever been to a ball? She continued after a moment of thought. Certainly. Did you dance? I've been known to scuff the parquet, the Count said, with the renowned glint in his eye, that little spark that had diffused heated conversations and caught the eyes of beauties in every salon in St. Petersburg. Scuff the parquet? Said the Count. Yes, I have danced at balls. And have you lived in a castle? Castles are not as common in our country as they are in fairy tales, the Count explained, but I have dined in a castle. Accepting this response as sufficient, if not ideal, the girl now furrowed her brow. She put another quadrant of fish in her mouth and chewed thoughtfully. Then suddenly leaned forward. Have you ever been in a duel? An affaire d'honneur? The Count hesitated. I suppose I have been in a duel of swords. With pistols at 32 paces? In my case, it was more of a duel in the figurative sense. When the Count's guest expressed her disappointment at this unfortunate clarification, he found himself offering a consolation. My godfather was a second on more than one occasion. A second? When a gentleman has been offended and demands satisfaction on the field of honor, he and his counterpart each appoints seconds, in essence their lieutenants, and it is the seconds who settle upon the rules of engagement. What sorts of rules of engagement? The time and place of the duel. What weapons will be used? If it is to be pistols, then how many paces will be taken, and whether there will be more than one exchange of shots. Your godfather, you say, where did he live? Here in Moscow. Were his duels in Moscow? One of them was. In fact, it sprang from a dispute that occurred in this hotel between an admiral and a prince. They had been at odds for quite some time, I gather, but things came to a head one night when their paths collided in the lobby, and the gauntlet was thrown down on that very spot. Which very spot? By the concierge's desk. Right where I sit. Yes, I suppose so. Were they in love with the same woman? I don't think a woman was involved. The girl looked at the Count with an expression of incredulity. A woman is always involved, she said. Yes, well, whatever the cause, an offense was followed by a demand for an apology, a refusal to provide one, and a slap of the glove. At the time, the hotel was managed by a German fellow named Keffler, who was reputedly a baron in his own right, and it was generally known that he kept a pair of pistols hidden behind a panel in his office so that when an incident occurred, seconds could confer in privacy, carriages could be summoned, and the feuding parties could be whisked away with weapons in hand. In the hours before dawn, to some remote spot. She leaned forward. Lenski was killed by Onegin in a duel. She said this in a hushed voice, as if quoting the events of Pushkin's poem required discretion. Yes, whispered back the Count, and so was Pushkin. She nodded in grave agreement. In St. Petersburg, she said, on the banks of the Black Rivulet. On the banks of the Black Rivulet. The young lady's fish was now gone, placing her napkin on her plate and nodding her head once to suggest how perfectly acceptable the Count had proven as a luncheon companion. She rose from her chair, but before turning to go, she paused. I prefer you without your mustaches, she said. Their absence improves your countenance. Then she performed an off-kilter curtsy and disappeared behind the fountain. An affaire d'honneur, or so thought the Count, with a touch of self-recrimination as he sat alone later that night in the hotel's bar with a snifter of brandy. Situated off the lobby, furnished with banquettes, a mahogany bar, and a wall of bottles, this American-style watering hole was affectionately referred to by the Count as the Shilyapin, in honor of the great Russian opera singer, who had frequented the spot in the years before the revolution. Once a beehive of activity, the Shalyapin was now more a chapel of prayer and reflection, but tonight that suited the Count's cast of mind. Yes, he continued in his thoughts, how fine almost any human endeavor can be made to sound when expressed in the proper French. May I offer you a hand, Your Excellency? This was Audrius, the Shalyapin's tender at bar, a Lithuanian with a blonde goatee and a ready smile. Audrius was a man who knew his business. Why, the moment after you took a stool, he would be leaning toward you with his forearm on the bar to ask you your pleasure, and as soon as your glass was empty, he was there with a splash. But the Count wasn't sure why he was choosing this particular moment to offer a hand. With your jacket, the bartender clarified. In point of fact, the Count did seem to be struggling to get his arm through the sleeve of his blazer, which he couldn't quite remember having taken off in the first place. The Count had arrived at the Shalyapin at 6 o'clock as usual, where he maintained a strict limit of one aperitif before dinner. But noting that he had never received his bottle of Vaudelaire, the Count had allowed himself a second glass of Daubenet, and then a snifter or two of brandy, and the next thing he knew, it was, what time is it, Audrius? 10, Your Excellency. 10? Audrius, who was suddenly on the customer's side of the bar, was helping the Count off his stool, and as he guided the Count across the lobby, quite unnecessarily, the Count invited him into his train of thought. Did you know, Audrius, that when dueling was first discovered by the Russian officer corps in the early 1700s, they took it to it with such enthusiasm that the Tsar had to forbid the practice for fear that there would soon be no one left to lead his troops? I did not know that, Your Excellency, the bartender replied with a smile. Well, it's quite true. And not only is a duel central to the action of Onegin, one occurs at a critical juncture in War and Peace, Fathers and Sons, and the brothers Karamazov. Apparently, for all their powers of invention, the Russian masters could not come up with a better plot device than two central characters resolving a matter of conscience by means of pistols at 32 paces. I think they do that in Anna Karenina, too, if I remember correctly. Anyway. I see your point, but here we are. Shall I press for the fifth floor? The Count, who found himself standing in front of the elevator, looked at the bartender in shock. But, Audrius, I have never taken the lift in my life. Then, after patting the bartender on the shoulder, the Count began winding his way up the stairs. That is, until he reached the second floor, landing where he sat, on a step. Why is it that our nation, above all others, embraced the duel so wholeheartedly? He asked the stairwell rhetorically. Some, no doubt, would simply dismiss it as a byproduct of barbarism. Given Russia's long, heartless winters, its familiarity with famine, its rough sense of justice, and so on, it was perfectly natural for its gentry to adopt an act of definitive violence as the means of resolving disputes. And in the Count's considered opinion, the reason that dueling prevailed among Russian gentlemen stemmed from nothing more than their passion for the glorious and grandiose. True, duels were fought by convention at dawn in isolated locations to ensure the privacy of the gentlemen involved. But were they fought behind ash heaps or in the scrapyards? Of course not. They were fought in a clearing among the birch trees with the dusting of snow, or on the banks of a winding rivulet, or at the edge of a family estate where the breezes shake the blossoms from the trees. That is, they were fought in settings that one might have expected to see in the second act of an opera. In Russia, whatever the endeavor, if the setting is glorious and the tenor grandiose, it will have its adherents. In fact, over the years, as the locations for duels became more picturesque and the pistols more finely manufactured, the best bred men proved willing to defend their honor over lesser and lesser offenses. So while dueling may have begun as a response to high crimes, to treachery, treason, and adultery, by 1900 it had tiptoed down the stairs of reasons until they were being fought over the tilt of a hat, the duration of a glance, or the placement of a comma. In the old and well-established code of dueling, it is understood that the number of paces the offender and offended take before shooting should be in inverse proportion to the magnitude of the insult. That is, the most reprehensible affront should be resolved by a duel of the fewest paces to ensure that one of the two men will not leave the field of honor alive. Well, that was the case, concluded the Count. Then in the new era, the duels should have been fought at no less than 10,000 paces. In fact, having thrown down the gauntlet, pointed seconds, and chosen weapons, the offender should board a steamer bound for America, as the offended boards another for Japan, where, upon arrival, the two men could don their finest coats, descend their gangplanks, turn on the docks, and fire. And we'll stop there before page 48, which is titled Anyway, another chapter, but we will stop there as it were. All right. Gosh, I really just love the language and the way he, I think it's a man who wrote this book, the way the author, I suppose, has phrased things and everything. It is just really, really good. Again, apologies for the traffic sounds. We almost got to the end without a siren, but alas, it was due. All right, and we will see you next time, me and maybe Honeycrisp too. All right, hope you enjoyed. Bye.